Good afternoon. My name is Sharon, and I'll be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the SpaceX Update conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you'd like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Mr. Elon Musk, you may begin your conference.
All right. Thank you. At the end of my little comments, we're going to post just a written version to the SpaceX website. So if you don't happen to catch something during my Bovil discussion, that you'll be able to look at that in the written form immediately after the Bovil comments end. Okay, so just going through the best of what we know thus far. And I do want to emphasize this is an initial assessment, and further investigation may reveal more over time. So I'll just run through it. Prior to the failure, the first stage of the vehicle was operating nominally, so there was no issues seen on the first stage roll. It actually continued to power through the overpressure event on the second stage for several seconds following the first stage coming apart. In addition, Dragon actually survived not only the second stage overpressure, but continued to communicate until the vehicle dropped below the horizon and out of range. In fact, if the software had initiated the parachute deployment, then the Dragon spacecraft would have survived. And for future missions, even for the cargo version of the Dragon spacecraft, we're now including contingency software that if something were to go wrong with the vehicle, Dragon will always attempt to save itself. This is certainly something that we have included in Dragon 2, which is the sort of crew, the next generation Dragon that will be carrying cargo and crew to the space station, but we've now advanced that activity to include it in Dragon 1 as well. So that's an unfortunate thing because we could have saved Dragon if we'd had the right software there. And so we've been going through the investigation with daily participation and insight from the FAA, NASA, and the U.S. Air Force, and I'd just like to say a word of appreciation for the help that we've received here. It's been great to have so much expertise reviewing the flight data. And we're looking not just for issues that occurred that caused this failure, but any near misses that could potentially affect future flights. So we're looking very closely at saying, just in general, is there anything that we can do to reduce the probability of failure with future flights? But just the fundamental nature of rocketry is that it is a case where a passing grade is 100% every time. It's not possible to issue a recall or a patch or anything like that. From the moment of liftoff, it's 100% or nothing. So we're looking for any tiny thing that could improve things in the future. Part of the reason why it's taken us a long time to at least come up with where the preliminary assessment is that there's such an enormous amount of data. We've over 3,000 telemetry channels, as well as multiple video channels and physical debris. And the key events in this case happened very quickly. From the first indication of an issue to loss of all data was just 0.893 seconds. So over the past few weeks, we spent thousands of hours going through a painstaking process of matching up the data across all telemetry systems down to the millisecond. It's very important to understand the exact sequence of what happened and then matching that to external video. And really, when milliseconds matter, it's remarkably difficult to actually line everything up exactly right. And as I said, the investigation remains ongoing, and we're continuing additional testing to fully validate these conclusions. So, again, this is just our preliminary analysis. The preliminary conclusion is that the failure arose from a strut in the second stage liquid oxygen tank. It was a strut that was holding down one of the composite overwrapped helium pressure vessels. So within the upper stage liquid oxygen tank, most in the tank are a series of high-pressure composite bottles containing helium. The helium is used to pressurize the stage. So as the oxygen and fuel deplete, you have to replace that volume with the gas and provide a minimum feed pressure to the engine and a pressure to structurally support the stage. It appears that one of those struts broke free during flight. Now, we do a whole bunch of tests on the ground, but part of the reason why that test did not identify the strut is something that's sort of quite unique to rockets. Is as the stage is accelerating, the buoyancy increases proportionate to the G loading. So it might seem sort of a bit counterintuitive that as the rocket's accelerating, that something immersed in the tank would actually want to go up more. But that's basically what happens, is the buoyancy increases proportionate to the G loading. So at approximately 3.2 Gs, the strut holding down one of the helium bottles appears to have snapped. And as a result, releasing a lot of helium into the upper stage oxygen tank and causing an overpressure event quite quickly. So it should be said, however, that we've flown several hundred such struts on every Falcon 9 vehicle, meaning there's a cumulative flight history of several thousand of these struts. Moreover, the strut that we believe failed was designed and material certified to handle 10,000 pounds of force, but actually failed at 2,000 pounds of force, which is a fivefold difference. Also, in examining detailed close-up photos of stage construction, we don't see any visible flaws or damage of any kind. So it's part of what caused us to be quite a puzzle. The telemetry data also, somewhat confusingly, shows a drop in the helium pressure system, which you would expect if there's a breach in the helium system, and then, somewhat strangely, a rise in the helium system back to approximately its starting pressure. This is obviously quite confusing, but we think what may have happened is that as the helium bottle broke free and twisted around, it may have pinched off the line to the helium manifold and restored pressure in the helium system, but released enough helium into the liquid oxygen tank to cause the liquid oxygen tank to fail. This is somewhat speculative, but that's the best explanation we can think of right now. So it's a really, really odd failure mode. Within the course of a second, that this caused the enough helium to be released, we believe, to overpressure the liquid oxygen stage or the liquid oxygen tank at the upper stage. And you don't really need to release a lot of helium because there's only about 2% gaseous volume in the stage, because the upper stage propellant is not being consumed. The first stage propellant is being consumed, obviously, as first stage is thrusting, but the upper stage is not. So, obviously, what we're going to do in the future is we're obviously not going to use these particular struts, and we're going to move to individually testing each strut independent of any material certification. So, no matter what something is actually certified to handle, we're not going to believe that. We're simply going to individually unit test every single strut. And this will result, obviously, in some cost increase to the rocket, but not, we believe, of a significant amount, and nothing that we think should affect the actual price of the vehicle, but nonetheless, it is some increased cost that we will apply to the vehicle. So far, the investigation is not showing any other issues. But as I said, we're looking closely for any near misses, and we intend to address anything that we can possibly think of to improve the probability of success in the future. But this is the first time we've had a failure in 7 years, so it's I think to some degree we were a little. I think the company as a whole became maybe a little bit complacent over the course of 7 years, and we're essentially 20 successes in a row. But I think this is certainly an important lesson and something we're going to take with us into the future. So with that, I'm happy to turn it over to your questions.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from Eric Berger from Houston Chronicle. Your line is open.
Yes. Hello. Thanks for having this call. I guess the question I would have is, do you have any estimate on when you'll be able to address the strut issue and get back to flying regular Falcon 9 launches?
Yeah, I think addressing the strut issue is fairly straightforward. We're switching to something which has an even higher margin of safety than what we had, which was already very high. And as I said, individually testing each one. So just based on this, moving to an absurdly strong strut and individually testing each strut, that would only push our flight out by maybe a few months. But we want to make sure that we've turned over every piece of data, that this truly is that we've diagnosed the issue correctly, and that there are not some other issues that need to be addressed as well. And then, of course, we want to make sure that all of our key customers are on board with that. So particularly NASA, Air Force, FAA, and our commercial customers. So we don't want to give a precise flight date until until everyone's on board with a new flight date. But just based on the strut, the strut itself does not significantly push out the next launch.
Your next question comes from Alan Boyle from GeekWire Cosmic Log. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for taking the question. I wanted to just get another, if you could explain how the strut led to that overpressure again. Did the helium tank come loose and then somehow the increased pressure of the helium got into the second stage tank? Just if you could go over the relationship between the strut coming loose and the overpressure again, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure. So in the liquid oxygen tank on both stages, but I was talking specifically about the upper stage, there are high pressure helium bottles. These are composite helium bottles that are at about 5,500 psi. They're stored in the liquid oxygen tank in order to chill down the helium that they contain to cryogenic levels, which improves the density of the helium considerably. Just a little bit beyond the failure, the helium from those tanks flows to the engines, or in the upstage case, the engine, where it is heated and then returned into the oxygen tank and the fuel tank to pressurize those tanks and replace the volume of oxidizer and fuel that is depleted while the engine burns. To provide pressure which structurally stabilizes the stage. So it looks like the strut, the key strut that holds down one of the helium bottles, So there's a whole bunch of these helium bottles. One of those struts appears to have failed. And as a result, it was unable to hold the helium bottle down. And so the helium bottle would have shot to the top of the tank at high speed because of the extreme buoyancy at the failure point of 3.2 Gs. Although we fire the stages on the ground and we do a stage hold down firing at the launch pad, the buoyancy force is only 1G, of course, because we're not accelerating. And so it would have passed through all of those tests without having an issue because it only sees high G loading in flight. It's very difficult, obviously, to test a rocket stage because the only way to fully test the stage would be to have some enormous centrifuge that doesn't exist on Earth that would centrifuge the stage up to flight acceleration. But that's just not possible. That would be the ultimate test, but there's no such physical thing that exists on Earth that could do that. So one is forced, therefore, to do these things by proxy, and the proxy is sometimes inadequate, as has turned out to be the case here.
Your next question comes from Marcia Dunn from the Associated Press. Your line is open.
What is the size of the strut that failed? How long was it? How thick was it? I'm sorry if I missed the material. And are you considering putting parachutes on future cargo capsules?
I'm not sure the exact dimensions of the strut matter that much. I mean, it's sort of about 2 feet long and about an inch thick at its thickest point. There are parachutes on Dragons always. That's how it normally lands. The issue is that in this case we didn't have the software on Dragon. Dragon is inert on ascent. Dragon 1. The software to initiate the parachute deployment was not in Dragon 1. It certainly was planned for Dragon version 2. And one of the things we've decided to do is to advance the software that was meant for Dragon version 2 into Dragon version 1 so that if something like this were to happen in the future, the Dragon spacecraft would save itself.
Okay, yes, that's what I meant. And will it be on the next flight, do you think?
The next flight of Dragon, yes, it will have the software to initiate the parachutes in the event of a launch failure.
Thank you very much.
Right.
Your next question comes from James Dean from Florida Today. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. Elena, could you just please clarify, did you say that you expected it will be at least a few months before you're ready to fly again? Which flight will that likely be? And I just wanted to also ask if this has impacted your commercial crew timeline at all.
I mean, the best I could say with respect to flying is that it's a no sooner than September date. It could be beyond September, but it's no sooner than September. We don't want to. It's also not clear who that customer will be, so I can't say exactly which. There may be some change of which customer it is on that flight. So do you have another element to the question?
Well, I was just curious if you know, as this has delayed, you know, the entire manifest, obviously, is it also
commercial
crew timeline?
I don't think this affects our commercial crew timeline because this doesn't affect the critical path on our commercial crew timeline, which is the critical path is really the design and validation of Dragon 2. So we're not expecting any change in that.
Well, thanks. And maybe I think Gwen spoke to this earlier, but would you affirm that you think a crew, how do you think a crew would respond in the system would respond if a crew were on the vehicle in a situation like this? Thanks.
Sure. If for Dragon 2, the system would have initiated an abort via the abort thrusters, so it would thrust itself away from the vehicle quite rapidly, and then once it was a decent way away from the vehicle, would initiate parachutes to land in the ocean. But as I said, even Dragon 1, which does not have the abort thrusters, survived the upper stage overpressure, and we actually received telemetry all the way until just above the ocean, where we lost line of sight in the telemetry. So, if, even with Dragon 1, without the abort thrusters, if it had initiated chute deployment, the cargo would have been saved, or a crew would have been saved, conversely. So that's unfortunate. We didn't have that software in on this mission, but certainly will be there on other Dragon 1 missions. And it was always baseline to be there for a crew mission.
Your next question comes from Dana Hull from Bloomberg News. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. The struts in question, were they made in-house by SpaceX or were they furnished from a supplier?
The part that failed was from a supplier, but I mean we're not going to name the supplier because I think that just results in recriminations. But it was not made at SpaceX, and we were relying on material certification from a supplier, and so there with that in the future we. Independent of material certification, we will be individually testing each strut.
Okay, and would you ever consider just bringing that in-house as well? I know that one of SpaceX's claims to fame is that so much of the rocketry is made in-house by SpaceX in Los Angeles. Would you consider making the struts yourselves as well?
In this case, we don't think the strut is something we need to make in-house. We are going to be long-term switching to a different strut design from a different supplier, most likely. But I don't think this is likely to be done in-house. Not this particular component. And I should say, while SpaceX does all of the major components in-house, we have hundreds of suppliers that supply sort of minor components. It would be very difficult for us to insource all of those.
Sure. And then real quickly, in terms of debris, how much of Dragon was recovered? It sounds like it did a heroic job, given everything that went on during that event.
It did. It's somewhat tragic that it unfortunately hit the water quite hard and is sort of in at the bottom of the ocean. We were actually trying to send a remote submersible down to the region where the debris hit the water and to see if we can retrieve additional elements of debris to either confirm our initial conclusions or point us in a different direction. That is probably the saddest thing about this is that if with just a bit of different software, Dragon would have made it.
Your next question comes from the line of Irene Klotz from Reuters. Your line is open.
Have you guys been able to replicate the failure, and have you eliminated all other failure possibilities from your fault trees? Thanks.
We have been able to replicate the failure by taking a huge sample of these, essentially thousands of these struts, and pulling them, and then we found a few that pulled far below their certificated level, and that's what led us to think that this that essentially there was one that was just far below its rated capability that happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. But as I said in the beginning of the call, we do want to characterize this as an initial assessment, and and it's subject to further review of the data to eliminate any other possibilities in the fault tree. But right now, there doesn't seem to be any other explanation that could make sense, but we're continuing to investigate.
Thanks. And what was the material that the strut's made out of, and any rough idea of how much it cost?
I don't want to get into too much detail on this. We're getting into the nitty-gritty, and it sort of invites a lot of armchair analysis that isn't actually correct. So, just broadly speaking, it's made of steel, but like I said, it's not something that should ever have failed at this force level. It appeared to be incorrectly made, but with no visible way of determining that from the outside. So.
Thanks, Elon.
Okay, your next question comes from Frank Morig from Aviation Week. Your line is open.
Thank you. Could you tell was there just the one strut holding the tank, or how it fit into the structure of the LOX tank? Was there more than one, and where on the strut, if you could say, where did it fail, or do you know?
Yeah, we have a pretty good sense for this one strut sort of holding it in the vertical direction. The strut is oversized to be able to handle far in excess of the projected load. In this case, it failed far, far below its, it failed 5 times below its nominal strength, which is pretty crazy. It appeared to fail at the bolt head, most likely. The steel bolt head, it appears to have failed there, we think. It's hard to get into the nitty gritty, because then it makes it sound like far more definitive than it is. With further investigation, turn out to be something else. Yeah.
In your redesign, are you adding another strut or more than one somehow to strengthen it beyond what you had this time?
We don't think that more than one strut makes sense. It just needs to be a strut that each strut is going to be individually tested, independent of its material certification. The strut is meant to handle more than twice the actual load that it experiences. So you could, in principle, divide that into two struts, but you're not really gaining anything if you do that.
Thanks.
Right. Your next question comes from Bill Hayward from CBS News. Your line is open.
Thank you. Is it just the one helium tank, Elon, or is there more than one? And I'm curious, based on what you just said, is there actual data that indicates a strut broke versus one of the helium overwrap tanks, bursting on its own? How can you differentiate that sequence, if you would, please?
Sure. At the risk of being a bit repetitive, I do want to emphasize we're not characterizing this as a definitive result. We're characterizing this as a preliminary result, as the most probable outcome, not as a definitive outcome. There are several helium bottles in the upstage oxygen tank. It actually depends on some missions have more helium bottles than others, but there are a whole bunch of them. The reason we don't think that this was, there are a few reasons. These are just things that make it more probable rather than less probable. Is that if we look at acoustic triangulation, so if we have microphones or technically accelerometers at various points on the upper stage, and by looking at the exact timing of high frequency events in the on the stage, we can by acoustic triangulation identify the location where the snap occurred or the breakage occurred. Because it's obviously really a sound. And the acoustic triangulation points to the support strut as the most probable location. Also, if let's say the helium bottle liner broke, the composite overwrap is not going to break, but if there was a crack in the metal liner of the helium bottle, it would have resulted in a continuous release of helium, and you would have seen much more helium released than if the bottle had simply broken free and could thus twist tight closed the line that connects it to the rest of the stage, which would explain why the helium pressure initially drops and then restores.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from Jeff Faust from Space News. Your line is open.
Yeah. Have you briefed various customers and insurers about your preliminary results so far, and what sort of feedback or reaction have you gotten from them so far? Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. In deference to our customers and the government, we've made sure to brief them last week and before briefing the public today. And so they've looked at all of the same data that we have. They have complete access to the same data that we have, limited only in the case of international customers by ITAR. And they agree with our conclusions thus far, again, emphasizing that they are preliminary and we need to continue working through the full tree. I'm happy to say that every one of our customers has been supportive, none of them have indicated a diminished faith in SpaceX. So I'd just like to give a word of appreciation for the support of our customers.
Your next question comes from Scott Powers for Orlando Sentinel. Your line is open.
Thank you. I'm wondering if you have the same strut and helium tank configuration on the lower stage or something similar to it.
There is. It's the same strut on the upper and lower stage.
So you'll be replacing it in both stages?
That's correct, yeah.
Was there any risk
and
that the lower...
And I should say the strut has flown on many, many prior flights.
Is there any risk that the lower stage struts could have reached the same G levels? I guess they would have already done that at that point.
Yeah, they were all at the same G levels. Now, the buoyancy force, once the liquid level drops below the position of the helium bottle, the buoyancy force drops dramatically, of course. But that was not the case at that point. All the helium bottles were experiencing approximately the same buoyancy force.
Thank you.
Both upper and lower stage.
Your next question comes from Dan Vertano from BuzzFeed. Your line is open.
Thanks very much. You'd said the shame of this was that the Dragon parachutes weren't enabled with software to fire. I'm just wondering, why weren't they? Was that just too much trouble, or was there a decision that went into that?
With the version one, the Cargo Dragon, it was not. It was just not something that had been done yet. So it was on the agenda, but it hadn't been done yet. And it was certainly planned for Dragon version 2 for both cargo or crew. So it was planned to be done. It just had not been done as of that flight. It will be done as of the next flight.
Thanks very much.
Your next question comes from Mike Wall from space.com. Your line is open.
A lot, Elon, for actually doing this. Yeah, I mean, like you mentioned that like you guys may have gotten a little complacent like over that long run of success. Could you just go into a little detail about, I mean, how do you think that sort of manifested itself? And so how is this incident going to change your guys' outlook going forward?
Sure. Well, you know, obviously we had, you know, several years ago in the early days of Falcon 1, we when we were just sort of learning how to make rockets, we had some challenges there with the first Falcon 1 flights. I think that instilled an extreme level of paranoia in the whole team. But, you know, 7 years ago, which is when we had our last failure, the company was only about 500 people, and now we're 4,000 people. So the vast majority of the people at the company today had only ever seen success. And when you've only ever seen success, obviously, you don't fear failure quite as much. Now before every flight, I always send out an email company-wide saying, if anyone can think of any possible reason to hold off on launching, that they should call me immediately on my cell phone or send me an email, whether their manager agrees with it or not. But that's sort of something I've always sent before every flight. But you know, the 20th time I send that email, it just seems like, you know, there's Elon being paranoid again. So maybe it doesn't resonate with the same force. But I think now everyone at the company appreciates just how difficult it is to get rockets to orbit successfully, and I think you know, we'll be the stronger for it.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from Ken Creamer from Universe Today. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for doing this. I was wondering about the struts. I understand you don't want to talk about the material of construction, but you said it was stainless steel. I wonder, can you say, would you at least change that material, maybe to a different alloy? And I'm also wondering about the abort thrusters. Might you consider installing abort thrusters on this cargo or using even an early version of Dragon V2 at some point to do the cargo deliveries? Thank you.
Yeah, we are likely, you know, this is still under review, but we are likely to change the material in the bolt of the support strut, most likely to Inconel, but that's, again, still preliminary. And then with respect to the abort thrusters, the abort thrusters are really quite a radical change in design, it wouldn't be easy to retrofit those to Dragon 1. Dragon 2 is very different from Dragon 1. It sort of looks maybe sort of similar from an external standpoint, but there's no reasonable way to just sort of tack on the abort thrusters. The best thing to do is to try to get to get Dragon 2 to flight at the earliest opportunity, because it is a step function improvement in capability and flight resilience. Although, as I said, we are going to make the software change to Dragon. But Dragon is quite a tough creature, even Dragon 1. And as I said, it actually was okay, even after the upper stage explosion. It was broadcasting its telemetry all the way to when we lost line of sight just above the ocean. So it's quite tough, and even without the abort thrusters, like I said, would have made it. So really, it's just a question of, you know, firing the chutes, and so we're gonna make sure that before we fly Dragon 1 again, that it has that ability.
Thanks, but is there any chance that you would fly an early version of Dragon 2 as a cargo Dragon?
The first Dragon 2s will be without astronauts. So at least one flight, maybe two flights, will be without astronauts. The first one would, in fact, carry cargo.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from Stephen Clark from Space Flight Now. Your line is open.
Hi, Elon. Thanks for taking our questions. A couple of questions. You mentioned you've tested these struts on the ground, and some of them failed. Did they fail at sort of the 2,000-pound force mark, or where do they fail? What sort of loads do they fail under in these ground tests? And also, with a few months' delay in your manifest, do you expect the first flight of Falcon Heavy will probably slip into next year now? Thanks a lot.
At first, we didn't think it was the strut because we tested a whole bunch of struts. None of them failed at a level like the lowest we saw anyone fail was at 6,000 pounds before. So at first, in the initial part of the investigation, when we tested a whole bunch of these struts, none of them failed below 6,000 pounds. So we thought, well, that couldn't be the issue. So we started looking elsewhere, couldn't find any issues, couldn't find an explanation for the data anywhere else. So then we got just a huge number of these struts with this particular bolt. And after testing some enormous number, we were able to find one that failed below the 2,000-pound level. So it was sort of a statistical thing. And then we did some material analysis on that and found that there were problems with the grain structure of the steel. It hadn't been formed correctly, so we think that probably was a bad bolt that stuck through that looked good but wasn't actually good on the inside.
Your next question comes from Tim
Falcon Heavy.
Oh yeah, right, the Falcon Heavy. I think given our focus on Falcon 9, we've deprioritized Falcon Heavy to probably launch in the spring next year, so maybe April or so.
Okay. Your next question comes from Tim Fernholz from Quartz. Your line is open.
Hi, guys. Thank you for taking time to do this. Just two questions. Can you describe the insurance coverage that you had for that rocket and for Dragon and its cargo? And have there been any costs SpaceX has had to pay because of delays to its commercial launch contracts?
No, the launches, we don't insure our launches. It's actually quite, and I think nobody in the rocket business does, except for potentially third-party damage on the ground, which is a super low probability thing. So it was no launches there. The biggest penalty is SpaceX will be the delay of launch rate. So if sort of like an airline, if the flights don't take off, then you'd lose the revenue associated with that period. So the lost revenue will be meaningful. I mean, in the hundreds of millions probably because of the implied delays.
Thanks.
Your next question comes from Joe Papalardo from Popular Mechanics. Your line is open.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking the call. Most of my questions have already actually been addressed, but I wanted to know in particular if you had recovered anything from the debris that helped at all, and you said you had put in an RV, a submersible. Was that, do you have any details on that, and was anything recovered from those efforts? Thanks.
We did find a small amount of debris that was floating. Most of it's at the bottom of the ocean. The remote submersible, we haven't gotten the feedback from that yet. I think it's going out soon, but it's a lot of area to search. It's pretty dark down there, so I wouldn't give. We're just doing that as sort of because we want to do everything we can think of. And if we do find something, obviously we'll feed that into our failure investigation. But so far we've not. I don't think it's actually reached the area in question. So we just have a small amount of floating debris that's been.
Your next question comes from Sophia Chen from Wired. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for doing this. I just wanted to ask, I had two questions. One was, so you mentioned the strut is supposed to be able to take 10,000 pounds. How much force do you actually need? And then my second question is, between these successful launches and this particular failure, how has the design of Falcon 9 changed, or if at all?
Yeah, so the actual force experienced in flight is proportionate to the G loading. So since it failed at 3.2 Gs, the max Gs is that it experienced depending on mission is maybe 5 to 5.5. The most amount of force it would really experience would be maybe 3 to 3,500 pounds of force. So it's sort of, theory was failing at three times below. If it had reached the worst case at the end of flight, it would have been 3,500 pounds of force. But still, three times below its nominal rating. I think the way that this, what we'll be doing going forward is doing a lot more individual unit tests, so essentially pull tests on all the supporting hardware, so that even if something is material certificated for very high loads, that's nice, but we're not going to believe the certificate. We're going to test it as well.
Your next question.
My next question was how has the design of Falcon 9 is it different at all this time compared to the successful launches of the past?
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing you. Is this design different from prior successful missions?
Yeah.
Is that what you're asking? No, it's the design is identical to prior missions. So we've flown hundreds of these of struts of this exact design. It's actually thousands.
Your next question comes from Graham Starr from the Christian Science Monitor. Your line is open.
I just want to ask if you found that any of this was due to the way it was implemented by the SpaceX team or if you found it was purely material. And regardless of what you found, you've talked about focusing on individual tests of the struts, but does that change anything regarding future quality assurance or operations policies?
This was a purchased part, so it's not it's not really related to anything. I mean, we just install it at SpaceX. So we have the closeout photos from this particular mission, so even with looking at detailed high-resolution closeout photos, it appears perfect on the closeout photos. So there does not appear to be any assembly error, which you should be able to see from the closeout photos. The big thing is the big sort of policy change would be always at pull testing or compression testing, even if it's a supporting component that in theory has extremely high margins and has certificates to sort of allegedly prove that, the policy change would be ignoring the fact that it has a certificate and in theory very high design margins and applying a physical test to even the small support items of support hardware. We already do that for the macro items for the stage. The primary airframe is always tested, but we had not applied that to the supporting hardware, particularly where the expected margin of safety was extremely high.
Your last question comes from Sean O'Kane from The Verge. Your line is open.
Hi, Elon. Thanks for taking our questions. I know you talked about potential Falcon 9 delays and Falcon Heavy delays. I'm curious if you think this will affect the second commercial cargo contract being awarded in the fall by NASA.
I don't know. I don't think so, but that would be a question for NASA.
I mean your submission for that.
Oh, our submission? It wouldn't affect our submission, no. It has been sort of, just emphasizing the difficulty of rockets in general. Obviously, just for space station resupplies, I think most people on the phone know, the last year has seen three failures. So it was ours, Orbital Sciences, and the Russian Progress. So it's been a tough year, and each one of those failure modes has been quite different. So, it just goes to show, rockets are a fundamentally difficult thing. Generally when there's an idiomatic expression about something, there's a reason for it.
We have no further questions at this time. I turn the call over to the presenters.
All right, thank you.